Hey guys, if you've got a Bible, open up with me to Luke chapter 1. To Luke chapter 1. Thank you, Kristen. It's like you teach people to read for a living or something. That was great. Okay, so what we're going to do over the next 4 weeks is we are going to study the life of Jesus and the birth of Jesus. We're going to do it from four different perspectives. This week is Mary. Next week is Joseph. The week after that is we're going to look at the shepherds. And then we're going to look at the wise men. And each perspective sort of focus in on a particular theme, a particular importance of why the birth of Jesus is happening. And the goal is on that Christmas Eve service, that Christmas Adam service, is we'll have a chance to sing songs that are just all about the incarnation of Jesus. We'll have a chance to share the gospel to encourage us before Christmas Day. But today we got to look at this. And here's why it's an important conversation, because around Christmas time, there's a lot of distractions. So for example, when I was in Bible college in Clearwater, I worked at IHOP. I hated that job, but I loved the people I worked with. The reason I hated it was because you wake up really early and people are tipping like nothing because it's pancakes, you know? But the prices are still really high, but that doesn't matter because people feel like it's breakfast. But I loved the people I worked with. They were wonderful, but the vast majority of them were not Christians. They were far from God. Clearwater is a place that there's not a lot of believers, and so one day, my manager and some other servers, this is like you get there really early in the morning. I didn't love that either. So you get to work at like 5 in the morning because people eat breakfast super early. And they cornered me after the morning rush. And they looked at me and they said, "So what's the deal with your people?" And I'm like, "I don't know what you're talking about." And they're like, "What's the deal with your people, with you Christians, man?" They said, we just got cornered by a group of believers because they were so mad that we had a sign over the door that said, "Happy Holidays." And the manager's like, here's my issue with that. Number one, we're IHOP. We're not a church. And she said, the second thing is there's four other signs over here that say Merry Christmas. But it's like they ignored the signs and they want to make a big deal out of Happy Holidays. And I'm not saying that's not a time to have a conversation about that. But I am here to tell you those Christians missed an opportunity. They were more passionate about the verbiage and the semantics of a sign than they were about actually displaying Jesus to my coworkers that needed Jesus. And generally speaking, I don't know if you guys know this or not, I'm assuming you do, but people that are far from God, the way to get them to see the love of God is not to fight over a political, social issue, over the verbiage of a sign. That's not going to win people to Jesus. It's not going to. And if it does, it's just because of the grace of God. And so what I discovered is that there are even good intentions where people get confused of what Christmas is about. Christmas is not about saying Happy Holidays or Merry Christmas. I know we're taking Christ out of Christmas. I get the argument, but that's not what Christmas is about. Christmas is not about presents. Christmas isn't about vacation or time away from work. Christmas is all about Jesus. And if you and I aren't careful, we're going to find ourselves distracted, even distracted by good things, from the main thing, the most beautiful thing, the thing that matters the most. And I say this a lot in the church, but let me just say it again. My job as the pastor is to consistently preach to born-again Christians. That's my job. The goal of our time gathering is to equip the saints, that's you, for the work of ministry according to Ephesians 3 and 4. So the idea is that my responsibility is to call Christians to follow what Jesus has said. And so what we want to do for Christians is we want to just say, hey, let's slow down a little bit. And let's realign our hearts and our minds on who Jesus is. Now, Kristen read the main part of the text, but I do want us to look at just verse 26 really quick. 26 and 27, here's what it says. In the sixth month, the angel Gabriel was sent from God to a city of Galilee named Nazareth, to a virgin betrothed to a man whose name was Joseph of the house of David. And the virgin's name was Mary. All right, let's stop there. So here's what we discover, a couple of really important details about Mary. Number one, this is kind of self-explaining, but her name is Mary. So Mary, at the time of this appearance of the angel, was probably around 15 years old. She could have been as young as 13. Because the normal age that a young woman would have been betrothed was between the ages of 13 and 15. Now, for you and I as Westerners and as Americans in 2024, we hear that age and I get a little bit ick. It's a little weird, you know? I have a 13-year-old and just the thought of her getting married and having a baby at this age is just sort of overwhelming to me, you know? But the problem with us looking at that, because here's the thing, the Bible means something. So it's our job as students of the Bible to understand what the Bible is saying, not to project what we think it is based on our cultural context. And the reason that's important is because the average age in 2024 that people get married is 29 for women and 31 for men. That's actually spiked. It's been around the age of 20 for the vast majority of American history, but since the 2020s, it's spiked. And it's not because people are like having a hard time finding a spouse. That statistic is so high because in our culture, people would rather own a house than be married. People would rather have a master's degree than be married. People would rather, you know, have their career at a certain place before they get married. So we have all of these boxes in America that we want to check before we would even consider marriage. But that's not how people thought in the first century. They didn't think in that capitalistic manner. As a matter of fact, it was perfectly normal in the first century for a young teenage girl to be getting married and young teenage guys to get married. Here's part of why that is, y'all. Here's a cultural thing that we don't have any reference point for. The average person in the first century lived to about the ages of 25 to 30. So if you got to 31, you were considered like you passed the expected age of anybody around you. In addition to that, when you literally are going to die by the age of 30, generally speaking, you don't get to live in your parents' basement for a long time, okay? You have to grow up really, really fast. So when you and I see 15 or 14, whatever the age was, we imagine what the average 15-year-old is right now in 2024, but a 15-year-old in 3 AD was different. So most 15-year-olds that I know are 14-year-olds, they're chasing after guys. And their biggest challenge is making to keeping up with who Snapchatted them or what's going on Instagram. Whereas a 15-year-old back in the day, they were working 12 to 14-hour days or they were going to starve to death. So we just don't have a reference point for this because we live in a different culture and a different time. If we lived in an agrarian culture where people died young, we would probably understand this, but we don't. So don't let her age freak you out is my point. The second thing that we notice about Mary is she's from a town by the name of Nazareth. If you've studied the Bible before, you know that throughout the New Testament, Nazareth is mentioned. Nazareth was a very small town about 55 miles north of the city of Jerusalem. It was located in a region called Galilee. There was another region called Samaria that separated Judea and Galilee. Now, a lot of scholars debate, and you'll see this as I kind of work through this text. There's a lot of people that try to deny the virgin birth because they feel like if they could deny the virgin birth, they could call into question the divinity of Jesus. Because if that's not a miracle, then he couldn't have been God. And so you find all these like scholarly poking at the Bible to try to discredit it. One of those things is they'll say Nazareth wasn't a real town. They'll try to say it never really existed. This is exactly what most scholars believed for a very long time. But here's why they believed it. Because when you study the Old Testament, the word Nazareth, the city Nazareth never appears. There was a Hebrew scholar, a historian by the name of Josephus that lived around this time frame. He never mentions Nazareth. You can't find it in any rabbinic literature, no Mishnah, no Talmud. The name of Nazareth isn't mentioned in any of those things. The only place that you find the name Nazareth is in the New Testament, in the Gospels, and throughout the New Testament. So because of that, some people have said that means it must not exist. Well, the problem with that is we've found archaeological evidence now in 2024 that indicates that it was a real town. It probably had about 500 people who lived in it. So I would just say the fact that history is ambiguous to the existence of Nazareth, which that's not true. The Bible describes it. The point is the same that the author is making here. Here's the point. Nazareth is a town that nobody's heard of. If I could word it this way, it's like if you could drive through Nazareth, it don't even have a traffic light, you know? They might have a flashing light. There's no chain restaurants. There's no department stores. Bucky's are not looking to build one there, you know? It's this insignificant town in an unimportant region. Even you can see this in the New Testament, y'all. When Jesus is calling his disciples and he says he's from Galilee, his disciples, before they fully follow him, are like, nothing good can come from Galilee. There's no way the Messiah is from Galilee. And so that is the whole point of Jesus being born in Nazareth. That's not a coincidence. That is a strategic, sovereign plan by a God who's in complete control of history. God is choosing to call his home a no-name town because he's coming in lowliness and humility. The other thing that you can notice is that she's betrothed to Joseph. Betrothal was sort of their understanding of the way we think about an engagement. It was a commitment that you made before you actually had the covenant of marriage. But it's a little bit different than how you and I understand an engagement. Most of us believe in our culture that you are not married until your wedding day, and at any given point, if you want to abandon it and walk away, you have the freedom to do that, culturally speaking, around us. Now, most people don't do that, but some people do, and if they did it, and that's the right decision. It's better to do that than to get married in a way that you don't want it, you shouldn't be married. But in the first century, the betrothal process was sort of the beginning of the marriage, which meant you weren't allowed to break the betrothal unless you gave them a certificate of divorce. And you could only give them a certificate of divorce if they sinned in a particular way. You did not have the freedom, if you were betrothed, to go, "I'm not happy, so I'm out." That's not how marriage worked back then. The only way that you could, if there is a case of sexual immorality, if there is something sinful or wrong in one of the spouses, that was the only way that you could sever that covenant. And the betrothal period is important because even though you couldn't separate it, you were betrothed, which meant you had not been married, which meant you had not had sex yet. And the text says that Joseph is in the line of David. We'll actually come back and look at that in just a little bit. But the fact that she has not consummated the marriage yet is an important detail, because the next section says Mary is a virgin. So you guys got to understand, we live in a cultural context around us where the idea of having sex before marriage is just like normal for most people around us. As a matter of fact, you ask the average person who attends church and calls themselves a Christian, they'll either rationalize sex before marriage, or they will just pretend like the Bible doesn't say that. But the Bible does teach that God's best is preserve sex for marriage. And it's not a judgment thing, it's a love thing. That is this gift that we give to somebody, and you're only going to give it to a person who's willing to say, "I'm ride or die till death do us part with." If they don't love you like that and they're not willing to make that commitment, you don't give them that piece of your soul and your heart and your mind. Because sex is always physical and emotional and spiritual. It's all three. So you only give it to them in the context of marriage. And Mary has not done that yet. She plans on doing it with Joseph. It's ahead of her, but she hasn't done it yet because she's still in the engagement betrothal season. And the reason this is an important detail is because Mary's a virgin. There's some scholarly debate over what this word means because people try to attack the Bible. Some people will say the word virgin doesn't mean somebody who has not had sex, but some people say it just means a young woman of marriageable age. Now, it is true that it means a young woman of marriageable age, but it's also true that it means a young woman of marital age who has not had sex yet. And so the reason that they're doing that is because they're trying to discredit the virgin birth. Here's the problem with saying it just means a young woman. When you look at the same word that's translated to the Septuagint or the Old Testament, that word young woman is always referenced to a young woman who has not had experienced sexual intercourse. And so even if it does mean a young woman, the assumption is that she's hasn't slept around yet and that she's a virgin. Now, here's what I want us to kind of look at for our personal lives. If you notice, Mary is a woman that you would never heard of if she didn't have baby Jesus. And she's from a town that you and I can see is not really on the pages of history. And she's a virgin. There's not a lot of exciting things about her life. She's sort of insignificant. And that's the point of the birth of Jesus, y'all. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you guys have seen the movie Aladdin, but there's a scene in Aladdin, I'm talking about the old one, where he wants to impress the Sultan, he wants to impress Jasmine, and so he makes a wish that he'll become Prince Ali. And as he comes into town, it's like Prince Ali, right? Mighty is he, Ali Baba. It's like he is this awesome, powerful, significant leader. And he's got all these animals and he's fought all these people and there's people blowing fire. It's like there's this massive parade to display how awesome Prince Ali is. Now, when Jesus entered the world, he didn't come in that way. He doesn't enter the world in a way that throws a big parade and lets everybody look at him and he's bragging about his possessions and his accomplishments and his giftedness. No, when Christ comes to the world, he comes in a way that displays humility. He comes in a way that displays other people are more important than himself. That the love and lowliness of Jesus doesn't just permeate his ministry on the earth. You can see it in his actual birth, his incarnation. See, Mary is a person you and I would not have chosen to be the mother of the Son of God. We would have picked somebody who has more clout, more experience, more education, more better family line. But Mary is just this lowly person who's going to give birth to Jesus. So here's a thought. I don't know if you guys have ever felt this way. I read this in one of the commentaries. Did you ever just feel like you were too small for God to notice? too insignificant for God to be aware of you. Perhaps that's probably how Mary felt. So I just want to ask you guys, have you ever felt that way? Have you ever felt like, man, nobody cares about you or thinks about you, or you're insignificant, or if you don't, people don't see you, you know? If you've ever felt that way, then I would say you need to be encouraged by the life of Mary here. Because here you have this woman that we would never even see, but she's in the hands of Jesus, becomes this massively important person in the history of the church. And what gives her value and what gives her life purpose is she attaches herself to the work of Jesus. That our significance as people, our contribution to society and culture, and us, quote unquote, being noticed, serves its greatest purposes when we attach all of those identity markers in the completed work of Christ. And we live for His kingdom. We live for His fame. We live for His glory. When you and I find ourselves distracted for our glory, things get out of whack. And so Mary's insignificance is the point of this text, one of the points of the text. She's a nobody, but in the hands of Jesus, she's a somebody because she's going to live for His glory. So then the text goes on and gives us even more details. The angel speaks to her. The first thing the angel says is, "O favored one, the Lord is with you." Now, Mary is somewhat overwhelmed in the moment. She's young and she comes from a humble background, and this powerful being is standing before her and speaking in an audible way, and she's afraid. She's overstimulated, man. She doesn't know what to do. And the first thing the angel says is, like, it's okay. Like, God's for you. God's on your side. And then the angel says, here's the point of us gathering. I'm going to tell you everything. You're going to have a baby, and this is everything that baby's going to be. And it gives all of these descriptors that describe the baby. Number one, the baby that you're going to have is going to be great. Jesus is going to be significant. Jesus is going to be important. There'll be no more like Him. He's going to live a remarkable life that will go down as the greatest life that's ever existed and the greatest person that's ever existed. The text goes on to say that He will be the Son of the Most High. Now, in the language there seems to be an allusion to the high priest Melchizedek. If you don't know who that is, during the time of Abraham, there is this high priest that kind of makes an appearance in the book of Genesis, really briefly. But Melchizedek is sort of a foreshadowing of the Messiah. It simply means that Jesus is going to be this supreme being, this great high priest, that He's going to be the kind of high priest that reigns over everyone. Simply put, y'all, there's no promotions for Jesus. There's no raises. There's no climbing the ladder. He's at the top already. He is the highest ranking position a person can ever receive, the Son of God. Third, He's going to sit on the throne of His father, David. Now, we'll look at this a little bit more when we look at Joseph, because Joseph is actually in the line of David next week. But here's what this is referring to. In 2 Samuel 7, there's a prophecy, a covenant that God makes with King David. The covenant is spoken by his best friend, Jonathan. And this prophecy is saying that the kingdom of David is going to last forever. That there's never going to be an end to it. Every king's reign at some point will die. Every dynasty is going to go away in the world. And so because of that, we know that everything's temporary, with the exception to the reign of David. David's reign is going to last forever. And what the text is saying is that throneship and that kingship of David is going to be transferred to the manifestation of God in the person of Jesus. That Jesus is going to become the Son of David. That He's going to become the one who's going to reign across the earth, not through a nation, a political nation or a people. He's going to reign through the church that's made up of the people of God, made up of Jews and Gentiles, that God's kingdom is going to last forever and those things. The fourth thing it says is that the Son's reign will last forever. So not only is He going to establish a kingdom, but this kingdom and His kingship is going to be here forever. Y'all, we live in a world where presidents, senators, state representatives, governors, mayors, and school board members all have terms, and that's a good thing. And we can even vote them out. We can remove them. We can impeach them. We have policies and procedures that can remove bad leaders. But Christ's reign and His kingship has no term limits. He sits on His throne because He's the only one who's worthy to sit on that throne. He is the Lord of lords and the King of kings, and that reigning power has existed for all of eternity. And the kingdom that Jesus creates will never end. Y'all, this one encourages me the most. Because the kingdom of God that is he's going to establish and the growth of the church, the bride of Christ, will never be stopped. You know why this encourages me, y'all? Because sometimes if you do church long enough, you can just get frustrated. There are really bad pastors. There's really toxic leaders. There's really sinful things that goes on in denominations. That churches have a way sometimes of not being what they need to be. And then we have culture around us that sometimes attacks the growth of the church. They're antagonistic towards Christian convictions and beliefs. And what this text is saying is it doesn't matter what the culture does to the church. It doesn't matter when churches don't do the right thing. Nothing's going to stop the kingdom of God from moving forward. That if our church fails, there'll be another church somewhere else that doesn't. If churches in Palakka fail, there'll be other churches in other places that are flourishing. That nothing can stop the kingdom of God. The word says it like this, that not even Satan himself can stop this ball from rolling down the hill. God is going to grow his kingdom in a way that's going to last forever. And nobody's ever going to stop it, no matter what. Last thing I want you to notice is the faith of Mary. So Mary hears all of this. She gets this proclamation, this prophecy that you're going to have a baby. And then she hears all the glorious, amazing things about the baby. She hears that the baby is going to be the Messiah. It's going to be God in the flesh. And what she says back is, how can this be since I am a virgin? That's a valid question. Now, Mary is not asking this question out of a heart of unbelief. The reason we know that is because if you go back just a little bit in the same chapter, an angel appears to a guy by the name of Zechariah. And there's a prophecy that Zechariah and his wife were going to have a baby. The baby wasn't going to be the Son of God, but the baby was going to be John the Baptist. And John the Baptist is going to pave the way for the Messiah to come. But Zechariah is like really, really old, and so is his wife. They're way past the age that people have babies. And Zechariah asks a very similar question to what Mary asked. Zechariah says, how can this be? Because I'm old. And when Zechariah asked that question, he must have had unbelief. Zechariah must have asked it with a little bit of skepticism, with a little bit of like, are you sure you could do this? Like, don't you know us? Don't you know our context? So he asked in a way that wasn't believing. We know that because the second he asks that question, the angel rebukes him and inflicts silence on him until the baby's born. So because of that rebuke, we know that he was filled with unbelief by asking the question. And so when Mary asks a similar question, she's not rebuked. She's not corrected. She's not like mouth silent, you can't talk until the baby's born, which seems to be that she's asking this question in faith. Now, I just want to pause here for a second, okay? You know that when you ask God questions, it's okay. And when you come to God and you say, God, I don't understand this. Or you say, God, this doesn't make any sense. Or you say, God, I'm just having a hard time with this. When you posture your heart in a way that asks those questions, always believing that he's good, always believing that he's God, even when you don't understand it, it's all good. Like, God allows us this freedom. The thing that God gets frustrated with is that when we ask questions and we just deny his power and we deny his awesomeness and we don't actually believe he's good and we don't actually believe he can work things out. That's how Zechariah said it. Zechariah basically is like, are you sure you're powerful enough to do this? Because I'm really old. Mary is like, I know you're powerful enough to do it. I just don't understand how you're going to do it. One is of faith and one is of unbelief. And her logic is legit. She's like, I'm a virgin. I'm no doctor. But according to this conversation called the birds and the bees I had with my parents, it ain't happening unless you have sex. So this is impossible for me to have a baby. And the angel answers that question. The angel says, the Spirit of God is going to do something miraculous in your womb. That God is going to do a supernatural work because he's a supernatural God for a supernatural purpose. And God's going to do all of this through the Spirit of God giving the baby Jesus and putting him into your womb. Because the angel goes on to say, for nothing is impossible with God. God can do anything. Y'all, theologians call this, fancy word, the hypostatic union. Here's what that means. That means that God is fully man, but he's fully God. He's 100% human, but 100% divine. And that's bad math, but I've heard it said before, that's really good theology. It's this merging in the incarnation of Jesus that he's a human being, which means he knows what it's like to be one of us. He could be hungry. He could be thirsty. He feels pain when you hurt him. He knows what it's like to live in a world where people die and people get sick. He's experienced that, not from heaven, but from the earth, by taking on flesh and dwelling among us. And yet at the same time, he's God in every essence. He's fully God and fully man. And this is the moment that is going to happen, is in the womb of Mary. This is the way one theologian pastor said it: by the power of the Holy Spirit and the power of God the Father, a body was prepared for God the Son, who would be brought forth by Mary. Now notice what Mary says back. Mary says, "Behold, I am the servant of the Lord. Let it be to me according to your word." Now I want you to just think hard about this, if you don't mind. Because you and I have heard the end of the story. As a matter of fact, if you're not even a Christian, and you've been alive, at least in the South, you've heard about the birth of Jesus. So most everybody at some point has heard the story of how the angel appeared to Mary, and she had a baby, and Jesus lived a righteous, perfect life. And at the end of his life, he died on a cross, and 3 days later, he rose from the dead, and now he's sitting at the right hand of the Father, interceding on behalf of sinful people like you and I. We're aware of the narrative of Scripture. We're aware that this has already worked out, and we're already reaping the benefits of the birth of Jesus. But you know who doesn't know that in this moment? Mary. She doesn't know Jesus is going to be everything that he has claimed to be. She doesn't know how he's going to die and rise from the dead, and now he's sitting at the right. She doesn't know any of that. All that she knows is an angel is saying, you're going to have a baby, and this baby's going to be the Son of God. Now, the reason I think we need to pause and just think about that is put yourself in her shoes. God's going to tell you he's going to do something, and you're like, there's a million reasons why this is not going to work out, God. Or we're like, there's a million reasons why you don't need to pick me, pick somebody else. Mary could have said all these things, y'all. Check this out. Mary could have said, I don't want all this responsibility and pressure. I'm not qualified. I'm not good enough. Maybe you just need to go with somebody else, Lord. Mary could have said this: I got my own plans. I want to marry Joseph. I want to grow my family. Your plans contradict my plans. Everything that I've organized in my mind for the next 5-10 years of my life since I was a little girl, you're ruining. It's contradicting what I want to do. She could have said, nobody's going to believe my story. My family and my friends are going to label me a particular way because I'm not married and I got pregnant. And they're not going to believe that an angel appeared to me and scolded me. What if Joseph doesn't believe me? Like, I'm going to be destitute as a single mom, living in poverty for the rest of my life if nobody believes this story. She could have said, the truth is, God, I don't even know how you're going to do all that. So if you could just do me a favor, God, and you could just give me a little bit more details. If you could just, like, maybe let me see your whiteboard with how all this is going to flesh out. Give me some sort of vision. Give me some sort of sign. Then I'm probably more likely to trust you and follow you if you would just give me more stuff. But Mary doesn't do any of that. Mary says, I'm your servant, and I trust you. She says, your words are better than my words. If I could restructure that, here's what she's saying. She's saying, your plans are superior to my plans. She's saying, I'm going to trust you, and I'm going to walk by faith. You guys see the amount of faith that Mary has? She just trusts the Lord. And can I just say, y'all, if you want to be used by God, Here's the precursor to you being used by God. You trust him. He doesn't need you to be moral. He doesn't need you to be righteous. He doesn't need you to come to church. He doesn't need you to tithe. He doesn't need anything from you. What he needs from you is to believe him. And the Bible uses the language, that's faith, that we trust God. We believe him and we follow him even sometimes when it's difficult and it's hard. That's what Mary does here. She expresses faith. But one guy said it like this. He says, doesn't the expression of faith by Mary sound a lot like people from the Old Testament, even the New Testament? Number one, doesn't she sound like a lot like Isaiah? When Isaiah says, here I am, Lord, send me. Doesn't she sound like Esther saying, if I perish, I perish. I'm going to do the right thing. Doesn't she sound like Ruth saying to Naomi, your people will be my people and your God will be my God, even though I'm outside of your camp. I'm Moabite. but I'll follow your God anywhere. Doesn't it sound like Job, who experienced some of the greatest pain a human being has ever experienced? And in the middle of that pain and agony, he says, if he kills me, I will put my hope in the Lord. There's a Shane and Shane song where the language from there, he actually says, if God slays me, I will still trust him and follow him. Doesn't it sound like Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane praying, Father, not my will, but your will? So I'm going to ask James and his team to come back up as they're going to close us out in a song. So let's just close out thinking about this, y'all. What God requires of Mary is one single thing. It's faith. God only needs Mary to trust his plans and his words. Mary just needs to follow the Lord, and God will take care of everything else. So that's not only true for Mary, y'all, that's true for you and I today. What God needs from us is for us to follow him and submit to his agenda and his plans. And I do not know what challenges that you are facing today. And I understand not everybody's facing challenges, you know. Sometimes in the church, we can just be sort of like, I don't know what you're facing, and you're like having a good day, and now you feel down. That's not my heart, okay? But I do know that there are things in our lives that are hard sometimes. Maybe it's money problems. Maybe it's relational conflict. Maybe it's some sort of mental health challenge. Maybe that your job is hard, your life is hard, people, loved ones are sick. I don't know. There's like a bajillion things that you could have right in front of you. And if you're like me, there's this subtle temptation that when I face things, I want to feel like I'm in control. I want to feel like I could fix it. And me, I spiritualize it. Because I'm like, if I can memorize this Bible verse, if I could pray my way through it, if I could read this book, like I'm always thinking in that manner. And what I've realized over the years is I need to be like Mary, where I just say, God, I don't know how this is going to work out, but I know you're God. And I don't know how I'm going to navigate this, but I know I'm going to do it with you. See, Mary is not grasping at control. Mary is just simply saying, I'm a lowly servant of you, Lord. I'm just going to follow you. And that testimony should be the testimony of every single one of us. And I told you at the very beginning that this message is for believers primarily. If you're not a Christian, we would say we want you to trust Jesus. Like, put your faith in Jesus. He'll change your life forever and you will never regret it. But for us as Christians, man, we want to walk by faith the way that Mary did. We want to say, God, your plans are better than my plans. We want to say, God, I don't understand it, but I'm going to follow you still. That I'm going to walk by faith, not by sight. And so here's how I kind of want to close the service out. This is absolutely an element of the Christian life. And I wish it was as easy as, like, preach it, and then everybody goes and does it. That'd be awesome, wouldn't it? If you could just flip a switch. You've been struggling, somebody's like, stop that, and you're like, that doesn't help me. This is somewhat of a process and a journey. And there's a sense of grind in trusting the Lord when life is hard. So I just want to pray for you guys, those of you that may be struggling with this. It may not. I know it's not everybody. But if you're struggling with this, I want to pause and I want to pray. And then we want to just sing a song that's all about Jesus, celebrating his glory and his splendor. And here is the key to trusting the Lord, y'all. It is having a big view of who he is. It is seeing him with precision, not through the murkiness of the sinful world around us or our own sinfulness. The way that we trust him is we see he's worthy to be trusted. It's not self-love, it's more love of him. And so I just want to pray for all of us. So if we bow your heads and close your eyes. So Lord God, we sing a song so much that declares you are worthy of it all. And Father, I know not every person here is in a valley, but I do know there's a lot of hurting all around us. There's a lot of challenges to life, a lot of difficulty, a lot of things to be anxious about. But in the midst of all of those circumstantial things, you are still God. And you still stepped into the world. And Galatians 4:4 says that when the fullness of time had come, that the exact moment in the exact time frame that you planned, all the way back before the world was ever even created, you sent your son, born of a woman, born under the law. And you fulfilled the law in a way that I or no person in this room or on the planet ever could. And you endured the scorn of the cross and you rose from the dead to prove to us that you are worthy of it all. You are worthy to be trusted. And so, Lord, I just pray for every person in this room that has a hard time believing that. I pray for them that when sin is affecting us and pulling at our hearts, when pain and suffering confuses us, would you help them by the power of your Spirit to fix their eyes on you? And would you let the testimony of Mary be our testimony as believers? That we say, Lord, I'm your servant, and I'll follow you. If that is not the posture of our heart, God, would you begin the journey and the process of moving us in that direction? We desperately need your help. And so I pray for this time of singing, God, that your Spirit would move in our hearts. And it's in the name of your Son, Jesus, I pray. Amen.